Welcome to the Deadcast.
May 6th, 1993, West Memphis, Arkansas. Members of the Crittenden County Search and Rescue Team scour a small area of thick, dense forest and brackish swamp water known as Robin Hood Hills. They are searching for 3 8-year-old boys, Stephen Branch, Michael Moore, and Christopher Byers. The three have been missing since the previous evening when one of the boys' adoptive fathers, John Mark Byers, called the police to report them missing. Just prior to that phone call, the three families had looked frantically for their children before enlisting the aid of law enforcement. Since that time, the families, the police, and numerous members of their neighborhood have scoured the area, desperate to find them. One of those helping to search that day is juvenile parole officer Stephen Jones. At roughly 1:45 in the afternoon of May 6th, he spots a boy's black shoe floating in a muddy creek. Reports are varied as to what happened next, but what is known is that Jones had attempted to retrieve the boy's shoe and ended up in the water. Making his way through the water and back towards shore, he feels something brush against his arm. A moment later, he reaches around, and then a body floats to the surface. It's one of the missing boys. He is naked and hogtied. Not long after, they will find the corpses of his friends, both of them in a similar state of undress and tied with shoelaces, each wrist bound to the opposing ankle. The murders shocked and horrified the community, and it wouldn't be long before suspects were identified and eventually arrested. The men accused of the murders would eventually be convicted, with the oldest one, Damien Eccles, receiving the death penalty. Though much publicity has been given to the case in the subsequent years, those three men who were convicted would forever be known as the West Memphis Three. Hello again, and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling independent author Ian Totten. I'd like to wish you a happy new year, and thank you for joining me today as I dive into the case of the West Memphis Three. Couple little notes before I get into today's case. If you are interested in following me on social media, you can find me on both Instagram and Twitter at Author Totten. You can find me on Facebook at Ian Totten Author. There's a little tab on there. You click it and it will bring you to groups, and you'll see the Deathcast group. We're about 180 members at this point. If you would like to help support the show, I am on Patreon at Ian Totten Author, or on PayPal and Venmo at Ian Totten. Now that the plugs are out of the way, get yourself something to drink, sit back in a chair, relax. I've got my coffee and cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. So today we're going to be looking at the case of the West Memphis Three. And before I really get into it, a couple of things. This is that one case that I am absolutely obsessed with. I know it backwards, forward, up and down. My wife is sick of hearing me talking about it. And as anybody who is a member of the Murder, Mayhem, and Crime Horrors group on Facebook will tell you, I have my point of view as to what happened there, and I will vehemently defend it. I'm not going to be diving into the conspiracy theories that have been put out by the convicted killers and their supporters in Hollywood. Nothing that they have said has ever panned out in any way, shape, or form. I am going to be going directly off of court records, which can be found on the Callahan site. If you are curious about what that is, just Google search Callahan and West Memphis 3, and it will take you to the website. Every court record that is known to be available that was used in the trials is available on that website. I'm also going to be using the two books that the journalist Gary Meese put out concerning the case. He was actually living in West Memphis and working for the Commercial Appeal at the time of the murders and in the years following that. They are very meticulously written, detailed-oriented books. And I'm sure a lot of listeners are not going to like the path that I go down with this particular case, and that's okay. I've had Damian Echols supporters attack me online before, even had a few of them decide to go and spam a few of my books on Amazon with fake reviews because of my views on this case. And that's okay, because they are really small-minded individuals and I don't give them or what they believe much heed. With that being said, this is an extremely massive case, and it's so large that I don't believe I'm going to get through it in one episode. In fact, I initially, when I was laying out the first season, which we're in now, I thought of doing this one as my season finale, but I've decided against doing that. I figured it'd be a good way to start the new year with a doubleheader. As with previous episodes, there are going to be discussions about extreme acts of child abuse and murder, as well as some talk of ritualistic animal abuse. So, listener discretion is advised. Now, when the bodies of the 3 8-year-olds were found inside that muddy ditch in Robin Hood Hills, it was quickly discovered that they had been pushed down into the mud to try and keep the bodies from floating to the surface. And for some reason, the law enforcement officials that were on the scene at the time decided that it would be a good idea to get the bodies out of the water, and this really contaminated the crime scene much more so than it was already contaminated. And in doing this and the moving of the bodies, they found the boys' clothing. It too had been pushed down into the mud, some of it turned inside out, and it was held in place with long sticks that had been driven down through some of the clothing and into the mud to hold it there. One thing that was noted almost immediately was that the body of Christopher Byers had lacerations all over it, almost as though someone had stabbed him, and his penis and scrotum were heavily mutilated. It was speculated at the time that it had either been cut off or possibly bitten off. And again, this was a pretty horrific scene. The area that the bodies were brought up on was a muddy bank, and it was apparent to the police that were on the scene that somebody had washed off the side of the bank, as the mud was really slick and wet, almost as though somebody had gone to great effort to wipe it down. News of the murders spread through the town pretty quickly, and right here at the beginning, there's a couple of things that I am going to dispel. If you see any of the Paradise Lost documentaries, or mockumentaries as I think of them, because so much information was left out and people misrepresented inside of them, they tried to make West Memphis, Arkansas appear to be a very redneck Bible Belt town. That could not be further from the truth. West Memphis is just about a half a step above a ghetto. And I state this from people I know who have lived there, one of whom was a former professional wrestler who was very big in the industry in the mid-90s, who flat out told me that it's not a Bible Belt community. Most of the population is black. There are naturally a decent amount of Caucasians that live there as well, but it's not what has been portrayed in these films and in subsequent books as this, you know, backwater hillbilly town. The biggest moneymaker in the town was a dog track, which it is legalized gambling, if that gives you an idea. So the idea that it was, you know, filled with fundamentalist Christians is laughable, in that they would never allow something like that in a town that they were inhabiting in great numbers. The people that live in West Memphis, there's some middle class, but by and large, they're lower middle class and then below the poverty level. So when news of the murders broke and people learned about it, there was not this great big public outcry of it must have been Satanists or, you know, witches did this. None of that was at the forefront of people's minds. It was, oh my God, I can't believe this happened in our town. Now, after the bodies were found, the police naturally went and informed the families of what had taken place, and there's a very famous scene in one of the first Paradise Lost movies of one of the parents going into hysterics while the father, I believe it's Terry Hobbs, collapses. These murders had a devastating effect on the families, and they went to the parents one by one and got them to recount their steps from the night before. The reason being for this, usually when there's a murder, it's from somebody that knew the person. Since there were three children involved, they wanted to rule out the parents before they really began looking around and trying to find suspects. So we're going to look at the parents first. We're going to start with the Byers family. That'd be John Mark Byers and his wife, Melissa. Byers stated that he had taken his other son to court that day, and then he had gone to pick up his wife between 4:50 and 5:10. Melissa worked in Memphis, Tennessee. At the time that he left, Chris, his adopted son, was not at home. He was known to be out in the neighborhood playing with other children. There is a story out there that is not confirmed anywhere that at the time he left, John Mark Byers was upset with Chris for supposedly breaking into the house and taking food. But again, there is no evidence that this actually took place. And I bring this up because one of the narratives out there about John Mark Byers that evening is, upon returning home with his wife Melissa around 5:30, he saw that Christopher had attempted to break the seal on one of the windows in order to gain access to the house. He did go to pick up his son, Ryan Clark, from court after bringing Melissa home. And on the way there, he saw Christopher Byers playing in the street on a skateboard. So Mark Byers brought his son home and gave him, quote unquote, two or three licks with a belt. Some people have said that this was because of the attempted break-in. Well, both Byers and his wife later said that he had punished the child for playing in the street, something he had been warned not to do on multiple occasions, as they did not want him to be run over. After punishing Christopher, John Mark Byers drove to the court, leaving the young boy in the carport. And one person at court later stated that Mark Byers had said he was angry with Christopher for attempting to have broken into the house. Christopher was in the carport. He had been given a bag to pick up cans and other parts of, you know, garbage that was lying out there as part of his punishment. And Byers arrived at the courthouse sometime after 6 o'clock. Upon returning home, he discovered that Christopher was not there and began looking for the boy, as he had not been given a permission to go and play with his friends. He took both his wife and his other son with him, and they drove around the neighborhood, particularly on the streets Ingram, Goodwin, Wilson, and McCauley. During this first pass through, Byers went to one family's home, the Garner family home. The reason being for this is they wanted to know where Stevie Branch lived. They knew the other boy, but were not exactly certain of where his house was. He encountered a few other people around this time, including roughly around 6:30. He ran into two police officers at the Flash Market and informed them that he was looking for his son. He continued looking for the child, and right around 8 o'clock, John Mark Byers headed back to the house as it was getting dark out, and it was at this point that he placed his first phone call to the sheriff's department to let them know that his son was missing. The sheriff's department informed Byers that he needed to call the West Memphis Police Department, which he promptly did and informed them as well that his son was missing. Officer Regina Meeks responded. Not long after speaking with Meeks, Byers continued searching for his son and began going door to door. Shortly after 8:30, he encountered a little girl and a little boy who lived on 14th Street, who said that she had seen Christopher Byers and three other boys going into Robin Hood Hills. Not long after that, they encountered Terry and Deanna Hobbs outside the Moore's house. They spoke briefly before all of them went into the woods to look for the children, with Terry Hobbs going further into Robin Hood Hills at that point than the others. Now, that's according to John Mark Byers. At 9 o'clock, approximately, he returned home in order to change his clothing, as he'd been wearing shorts and flip-flops. Afterwards, he goes out and continues to look for his son, as well as the other boys who he is now aware of are missing. Between 9:45 and 10:15 approximately, John Mark Byers headed back towards Robin Hood Hills, where he encountered another officer, an Officer Moore, and they went and searched in the woods once again. Officer Moore later corroborated that he had indeed met up with John Mark Byers and that they had looked in the woods. After leaving the woods, they encountered a couple of other searchers who told them people were on another road searching, and they went to join them to help in their efforts. Now, around 11 o'clock, John Mark Byers returned home and called the police station. He spoke with Officer Regina Meeks and asked her what was going on. Meeks stated that she had informed her commanding officer of the situation, after which Byers called the sheriff's station once again. Following this, Byers and his son Ryan got into their car and began searching once again. I know initially there was a period of time that they threw John Mark Byers out there as an alternative suspect, but his timeline for that evening has largely been corroborated by other witnesses. So he was basically out searching most of the evening, searching for his son. Around midnight, Byers returned home, and not long after, he met Stevie Branch's grandfather, Dana Moore, Terry Hobbs, and a friend of Terry Hobbs who we'll meet when we get to Terry Hobbs' statement. They did another pass through the woods after having a brief conversation in the street. Between 1:30 and 1:45, Byers encountered a Sergeant Ball, after which, again, he continued looking. They looked up until roughly 5 o'clock in the morning for the boys before deciding that they needed to go home and have a little rest before going back out and searching again. Now we're going to look at the West Memphis 3 supporters' favorite alternative suspect, and that's Terry Hobbs. He was the adoptive father of Stevie Branch, married to Pamela Hicks Hobbs. Now, according to Hobbs, he got home somewhere between 2:30 and 3:30 that afternoon from his job working as a merchandiser for a local ice cream company. And he stated that when he came in the house, Pam was making dinner while the couple's daughter, Amanda, was probably inside Stevie's bedroom watching television. He noted that Stevie wasn't home and was informed that he was out riding around on his bike with Michael Moore. From the statement Hobbs gave, Stevie was supposed to be home around 4:30 as he had to drive Pam to work. She had to be there at 5. So during this period of time, he was in and out of the house constantly looking to see if he could find Stevie anywhere. Eventually, it was decided that they couldn't wait around any longer and hope that Stevie arrived, and Terry took Pam to work. Along the way, they stopped at the Moore household. Neither of the parents were home at this point, although their daughter, Dawn, was. And she informed the Hobbses that Stevie was out with Michael riding around on their bikes, and that she would let him know that his parents had been around looking for him when they returned. Terry then continued on, dropping Pam off at her job at Catfish Island before heading back towards their house. He and Amanda drove around the roads looking to see if they could spot Stevie and Michael. After doing this, they went back to their house, and they hung out for a little while before Terry decided that they needed to walk the neighborhood and see if they could find the boys. He eventually encountered Mrs. Moore, who was out looking for the boys, and they had a brief discussion in which Terry said, you know, how come you don't know where the boys are? They're supposed to be at your house. And it was decided that they would all go back to the Moore's house to wait for the boys to arrive. While at the house, he first encountered John Mark Byers, who was out looking for his son, Chris. Because of this interaction, according to Terry Hobbs, this is when the parents realized that all three of the boys were probably out together. Eventually, Terry decided that he would be better off looking for the boys rather than standing around at the Moore's house. So he got his car and they drove around a little bit before he dropped his daughter Amanda off at one of the neighbor's houses. And this would continue off and on for the next few hours with him going out and returning home. At one point, he went over to a friend's house, a man by the name of David Jacoby, where they played guitar for a little while. So it seems like he wasn't overly concerned that the boys were into some sort of trouble that maybe they can't handle. I'm sure, like most of the parents, he was just figuring that, you know, they were being boys and staying out later than they were supposed to. But eventually, Terry did go back to the house. At one point, Pam called, just checking in, let him know that she would be getting off at 9. He did not inform her that the boys were still missing, but he did go back out and continue looking for the children. He did meet Officer Regina Meeks, who had been called by this point. And somewhere in this time frame is when the term Robin Hood Hills was first brought to Terry's attention. He had never heard of it before. And they did go down and look in the woods for the children, but did not find them. He went and picked up his wife, Pam, from work around 9 o'clock, at which point he informed her that, hey, the kids are still missing, and they continued the search after that, with he and Pam actually going into the woods to look for the boys. She eventually went home because of their daughter Amanda, and pretty much the rest of his night was spent looking for the boys, either by himself, with other parents, or with his friend David Jacoby. And this has been confirmed by other parents, Jacoby, as well as his wife Pam, but the West Memphis 3 supporters like to throw out that he had periods of time when he was alone. This is not odd, as, again, he didn't realize that there was something serious going on. They also like to throw up the fact that he can't remember a specific timeline. This, too, isn't odd, because as you ask most prosecutors and even defense attorneys, and they will tell you that it's very rare for somebody to have a photographic memory of a day that, up until a certain point, is just like any other day in their life. But people like to make a big deal of this, and he should remember every single detail of it, and that's just not factually possible. Another thing they like to point out is that Terry Hobbs had a bit of a temper. He was known to use a belt on the children, as was Pam. And he also was known to get physical with some of the men that Pam would have liaisons with. Again, that's not out of the norm. I think most people who were in a relationship that, you know, stumbled upon their spouse having intimate contact with somebody outside of the marriage would react in, you know, a fairly violent and aggressive way. And even Terry Hobbs himself will tell you that, you know, he was not the best human being on the planet at that time. But, you know, he wasn't a intentional murderer, which is the narrative that likes to get thrown out. That pretty much covers the Byers and Hobbs family. The Moore family, there isn't a whole lot to tell. Todd Moore was a truck driver, and he was out until about 5:30 or 6 o'clock, at which point he got home from his route and began helping to search for the children. The wife was already helping to search for the children at that point. One thing that should really be noted is that they didn't have any suspects at the start. I know they like to throw around that they immediately zeroed in on their suspects, but that is not true. It was, you know, almost a month before they started getting an idea of who possibly could have been responsible for this. They did have some occult experts at the department who stated that, you know, this does in fact look like there might have been, you know, a ritualistic manner behind the slayings. And this is actually with precedent, because there were strong occult ties within the community, specifically in the Lakeshore Trailer Parks, which was mostly founded and inhabited by itinerant carny workers who were heavily interested in the occult. There had been a string of dog, cat, and other animal mutilations in the area over the preceding years. So they thought, based on what they saw at the crime scene, the wounds to the boys, and information they'd already had, that it was possible that some, you know, occult group could possibly have been involved, but they weren't certain at the start. They did look into the, you know, background of all the parents, even the parents who were no longer in the area, and quickly, you know, discounted them as credible suspects in the murder. There's the story of the Bojangles man. It was a black man who went into a fast food restaurant. He seemed to be disoriented, and he left blood and feces at the scene. From reading various police logs in the Commercial Appeal, this actually wasn't that strange of an occurrence. Again, there was a lot of drugs in this area, still are to this day. And people acting strangely out in public, you know, it was a pretty normal occurrence. Officer Regina Meeks, who, if you'll remember, was the officer who was called out to help look for the boys, did go over to the Bojangles restaurant. She just drove through the drive-thru to find out what was going on, at which point she found out that the man had already left. And it wasn't until the next day that they sent somebody else back out there to see the scene and found out that the bathroom had been cleaned. Which should tell you something, that they didn't think enough of this incident to, you know, insist that the police come in and investigate the bathroom or anything else, or that, you know, Meeks, you know, didn't think that it was a big enough deal that she actually got out and insisted on investigating it. You know, this was a fairly normal occurrence in West Memphis, and anybody who lives in a city, you know, can tell you that people being messed up on drugs and doing weird things in fast food restaurants or just out in public in general is, again, it's a really normal occurrence. One thing that the police did do was to begin talking to the teenagers in and around town to see if they knew anything or had heard anything about the murders. And in talking to the police, the teenagers and other children of the area kept making reference of occult activities in the area, which, again, as I talked about a moment before, the police did realize, you know, there was some occult activity going on, but I don't believe they realized the, you know, the youth in the area knew so much about it. In fact, a lot of people, especially from the trailer parks, were pretty heavily involved in the occult. A number of them considered themselves to be Wiccans. Although a lot of the people questioned insisted that this was a satanic killing, and three names kept being brought up throughout all of these questionings, and that was Damian Wayne Eccles, Jesse Miss Kelly Jr., and Charles Jason Baldwin. One of the things that has been bandied about over the years is that these three young men were unfairly targeted because they listened to heavy metal music, had long hair, and dressed all in black. One thing that the people don't take into account is the fact that this was 1993, and at this point, the band Metallica was the largest band in the entire world. So much so that you could hardly turn on a rock radio station anywhere in the country without getting hit with, you know, a block of what they called mandatory Metallica at the time. So the idea that these three young men were targeted because of this is pretty false, because the way they dressed was no different than thousands, if not millions, of other teenagers across the country at that time, and I say this having been one myself, you know, I was dressed all in black, had the long hair. I was never singled out for any of the crimes that took place in my hometown, nor is anybody else that I knew at that period were they singled out as well. What set these three apart was they had a demonstrated and documented history of violence, and that's another thing that likes to be contested, is that none of them had a history of violence. In fact, the defense team even got John Douglas, the FBI profiler, to come in and say that none of them had a history of violence in their pasts, but they neglect to point out the fact that they paid John Douglas to come to this conclusion, and at this point he's not working for the government, he's working for whoever gives him money. They, all three of them, had a history of violence. It's well documented, and I will be diving into it shortly. But at this point, the police really didn't know that much about the three young men, other than the fact that they kept hearing about this satanic cult, and these three names kept getting bandied about by everyone that they talked to. One of them was a woman by the name of Vicky Hutchinson. She's of no relationship to Damien Eccles. She had come forward at some point and informed the police that she had seen Damien and his girlfriend at the time, Dominique Teer, on the service road that led to Robin Hood Hills, and both of them were covered in mud. This was somewhere between 9 and 10 o'clock at night. The Hutchins family was all out. They were picking up the grandmother or the mother at the local laundromat where she worked. And everyone in the family knew them as they were related in some way, shape, or form to Dominique Teer. And everybody that was in the car swore that it was Damien and Dominique. One thing of interest here is that from a distance, Dominique could easily be mistaken for Jason Baldwin and vice versa. So that's the first bit of evidence against any of them that implicates them that they might have been there, is that this family actually saw, you know, definitively they saw Damien Eccles on scene and who they believed was his girlfriend. Now, a note in the police files dated 5/10/93 said that Detective Mike Allen picked up line one and talked with what sounded like an older white female who stated she had overheard that Dominique and a Damien killed the three little boys, and that LG, last name unknown, took and laundered their clothing. Caller stated that Damien had body parts in a box from the children. The caller stated she didn't give her name and that she heard that LG's mother was going to lie about LG's whereabouts. Now, this LG is an individual by the name of LG Hollinsworth, and he pops up off and on throughout this case. LG was interviewed, and he stated that he didn't know anything about the murders and that he was with a friend of his by the name of Richard Simpson at his house from 5:30 that night until about 9:30, which is interesting because Simpson later stated that he was not with LG until Thursday evening. LG also said that he had been on the phone with Dominique Teer that night, when he got home, and was on the phone with her until his mother got home. He also stated at a later date that he had actually gone to the laundromat to talk to Dominique's grandmother and get Dominique's phone number from her. From all indications, it seems that LG was kind of infatuated with Dominique, even though there was some form of familiar relations between them. We're going to jump back into Vicky Hutchinson again, because she pops up a lot in this case, her and her son Aaron. And I want you to keep in mind that all of this stuff happened prior to the three men being arrested and eventually convicted. Vicky contacted the police and went in and basically said that she had gone to pick up Aaron from school on May the 5th. She gave this statement on the 28th of May. And that he had been trying to convince her to let him go play with Michael Moore. And Moore apparently insisted that there was a Cub Scout meeting that night, even though there wasn't. Michael Moore was the child who was found in his Cub Scout uniform. And the reason for this is that he was really proud of the fact that he was a Cub Scout and wore the uniform whenever he had a chance to. At any rate, she told her son that he could not go and play with them. There was not a meeting that night. So after this encounter, they went back home. And it seems they had a pretty uneventful evening beyond seeing Damien and what they believed to be Dominie Teer on the service road leading away from Robin Hood Hills. The next day, she dropped her son off at school, went home, found out what had happened by watching the local news. She discovered that the boys were missing, so she decided to go over to the Moore house to see if there was anything she could do, after which point she got her son Aaron from school, and Aaron informed her that they needed to go down and check out the clubhouse, which was really nothing more than a pile of boards the boys had scrounged down in Robin Hood Hills. And, you know, boys being boys, they would probably go down there and pretend they were cowboys and Indians and army men and all sorts of things. So they went over to try and get into the clubhouse, and the police were already on scene. They had the whole area cordoned off. And the reason I'm talking about all of this is eventually Aaron began making some extremely wild accusations, that he had actually seen the murder, they were hiding in the clubhouse, and that he knew who had done it, that it was a group of teenage boys that they had seen down in the woods on a number of occasions who were engaged in homosexual sex. And that these boys were Eccles, Miss Kelly, and Baldwin. He also stated that the boys almost got him that night. And I'm putting all of this out there because I want to show that the police were, you know, actively investigating this case. They didn't just jump on these three, you know, supposedly wrongfully convicted young men. They were following up on any tip that came their way, and, you know, eventually they did completely disregard what Aaron Hutchinson was saying, because, you know, the stories he started to tell after a while were so outlandish. He started out somewhat believably and ended up in the realm of absolute fantasy. Vicky Hutchinson, on the other hand, you know, she knew two of the killers. She knew Damien, she knew Jesse. She consistently referred to Miss Kelly as little Jesse, that he was a good boy who would come over to the house and watch her son while she was out at work or running various errands. She stated that she had heard it around the trailer park that Damien had actually committed these murders, and because of this she wanted to get to know him. And she arranged for Jesse to introduce the two of them, and she played it off like she was trying to get with Damien. But at any rate, you know, she was, you know, a bored woman with nothing better to do, so she decided to take it upon herself to, you know, play detective. And she had a couple encounters with Damien. She even, at one point, said that Damien and Jesse had taken her to a witch's coven in another town. This she later retracted, said it didn't happen. And it wasn't until years and years later that she said that, you know, the whole sighting of Damien and Dominique was, you know, a complete lie, although the polygraph test she took at the time of the murders showed that in that instance, regarding what she had seen, she was telling the truth. But, you know, there was a lot of this kind of talk going around about Eccles, Baldwin, and Miss Kelly, so much so that the police eventually had to talk with the three of them. And, you know, all of this happened in pretty quick succession. I mean, as far as Vicki Hutchinson coming forward, L.G. Hollinsworth being talked to. Damien Eccles was actually first questioned on the 9th of May. And the answers that he gave police really didn't help his case any. In fact, the answers he gave is the reason beyond anything else that they kept coming back to him. When they asked him what should happen to the person that had committed the murders, Damien stated that they should get the death penalty. When asked why the person who had committed the crimes had done it, he said that it was a thrill kill. They asked him about what had been done to the boys, and he said, mind you, none of this was public knowledge at the time. He said that they had been cut up and that possibly there had been some form of sexual assault that had taken place, as well as sexual mutilation. He further went on to state that the person who had committed this was happy with the work that they had done. But the most damning thing that Eccles stated during this first brief questioning was that the boys had been placed into the water to wash the urine out of their stomachs. And the reason this is damning is, at the time, the police were unaware of it, but one of the boys was found to have urine in their stomach. Now, Damien's stating of this, that, you know, they had been put into the water in order to get rid of evidence, specifically urine, struck the officers who were questioning him as extremely odd and raised a red flag in their minds. And later, when they would get the reports back from the boys' autopsies and found that, in fact, one of them did have urine in their stomach, you know, these red flags turned into alarm bells. Around this time, too, the police were questioning, again, all the teenagers in the area. They started hearing about how Eccles and Baldwin were going around and boasting of the fact that they had committed these murders. The most famous case of this was at a softball game where Eccles had some form of confrontation with a few different girls and informed them that, yeah, he had done the murders and that they were looking for one more. This is, that's a really brief overview of what happened concerning that. It's actually quite a bit more detailed. He went on to say in later years that, you know, he doesn't remember saying it, and then that he does remember saying it, but he meant it jokingly. I was a screwed up, dark, brooding teenager myself, and I said some pretty outlandish things, so I can grasp the idea that if he said it, it was a joke, because again, I said some pretty outlandish things myself. The fact, however, that he consistently told people that he was responsible for the crimes, and that these people who were found to be reliable witnesses reported this to the police, gives more credence, at least in my mind, to the fact that he was involved in the murders. But again, at this point, Eccles really wasn't a suspect. The police were just questioning him. They were questioning a lot of different people, and they had questioned him because his name had come up a couple of times. But at that point, he really wasn't a viable suspect. What made him a viable suspect in the police's minds, beyond his incriminating answers to the questions they presented to him was the fact that Echols' probation officer, Jerry Driver, actually told the police a little bit about him and said, you know, he's into the occult, he's into Wicca, Satanism, whatever. He's got a history of violence. He's on record as being homicidal and suicidal in the past year. You really need to look at this kid. And that's what shifted the police's, you know, attention from other avenues, is that the probation officer, you know, threw him out there as this guy could very possibly be the one that was involved. And so the police started really looking into Damien Echols and his background. They started questioning people that had known him prior to the murders. And the image that began to emerge was much, much different than the image that has been presented to the media by Echols and his Hollywood supporters over the ensuing decades. What they found was that he was a very dark, sinister young man who had serious mental issues, and he was known to be a danger to both himself and others. And this was noted as far back as his early childhood. His mother also had a history of debilitating mental illness. Damien's early years were spent first with his birth father and mother. The mother eventually divorced his birth father and would marry another man. Now, the Echols family was, you know, a low-income family prior to this, and they fell further into poverty after the remarriage, as the family eventually moved into what can only be described of as a tar paper shack in the middle of the field where his stepfather worked. And his stepfather has said repeatedly that, you know, Damien as a young child, it was obvious to everyone that he had, you know, mental issues. He would begin crying for no reason whatsoever. He was listless, always, you know, in motion, and if he wasn't in motion, he would be sleeping. He had a number of pretty serious health problems, and that overall, he was just a very, very unhappy child. This is in stark contrast to the, you know, picture-perfect image that Damien himself paints, that, you know, they were a middle-class family, and that the places they lived, you know, would be considered middle-class by today's standards, yada, yada, yada. Reality is they lived in, you know, what most people envision when they picture a trailer park, followed by a shack, followed by more trailer parks. And it was noted that pretty early on, Damien was a bit of an outcast, even among the dirt poor kids that he went to school with. Eventually, he became friends with Charles Jason Baldwin over cassette tapes, and they were pretty fast friends. In fact, they eventually became blood brothers. And not too terribly long after this, despite the narrative, Jesse Miss Kelly came into their sphere of influence, and according to Jesse Miss Kelly himself, that he thought they were sort of friends. And other people have corroborated this, saying that more often than not, though they didn't hang out on a daily basis as Damien and Jason did, the three of them could be found together. Again, this isn't, you know, hyperbole on my part. This has been verified by dozens and dozens of different accounts that took place both at the time of the murder and were given years after the fact. Now, Damien's propensity for violence is long and well documented. A number of people came forward both before and after the arrest, given accounts of how Damien would take sticks and jab them through frogs in order to see how long it took the animals to die. He was also known throughout the trailer parks for killing dogs. One account describes how he and a friend were walking and came across an injured animal, and how Damien had cut the animal open and removed its intestines. And similar accounts to this were given by a lot of different people. I'm going to read an account now given by a witness as to one of the acts of animal cruelty that Damien Eccles perpetrated. On 10/27/92, I was at Lakeshore Trailer Park with Damien Eccles when he killed a black Great Dane. The dog was already sick and he hit the dog on the back of the head. He pulled the intestines out of the dog and started stomping the dog until blood came out of his mouth. He said he was going to come back later with battery acid so that he could burn the hair and skin off the dog's head. He had two cat skulls, a dog skull and a rat skull that I already knew about. He kept these skulls in his bedroom at Jack Eccles' house in Lakeshore. He was trying to make the eyeballs of the dog he killed pop out when he was stomping. Damien had a camouflage survival knife to cut the gut out of the dog with. And this is just a brief glimpse into the kind of things that Eccles was known to participate in prior to the murders. That Eccles was heavily into the occult is something that during his incarceration he really tried to attempt to downplay quite a bit. But prior to the murders, he was very open and frank with people about his beliefs. And so much so that there's a piece of evidence that was put together by his defense team after his conviction concerning his mental health status. I forget the exact name, but it's something along the lines of, you know, evidence number 500, because it's a 500-page long document. It is littered with Eccles' own discussions and thoughts about the occult, and it includes a lot of the paperwork from his time in various mental health institutions prior to the murders. Now, after he got out, of course, he was right back into the occult, so much so that he has pretty much made a living off of it. He kind of sees himself as a modern-day Aleister Crowley. But at the time of the murders, that was his entire life, despite what has been said. This plays into his various stints in mental hospitals, the first of which began on June 1st of 1992. At the time, Eccles was going out with a 15-year-old girl by the name of Deanna Holcomb. They'd been going out off and on and had actually broken up earlier that spring at the insistence of her parents, which led to Damien making what was termed as terroristic threats, for which he was charged. Damien was able to convince Deanna to run away with him, and he did this with the help of his mother, who gave them $10 to $15. They were eventually found half-clothed inside of an abandoned trailer. They were actually inside of a closet when the police found them. It doesn't state exactly what they were doing, but it's been inferred through various things that I have read that they were in the act of intercourse. And Eccles, who was 17 at the time, was arrested for this, along with Deanna, and they were charged with breaking and entering and sexual misconduct. They were taken to the police station where they were permanently separated, and this drove Damien to attempt to kill himself inside of his cell. One interesting thing, a note that occurred during all of this, as he would later tell a psychiatrist, is that he was inside the police car and watched as Deanna's father began to approach. And according to Eccles, the officer had left his gun inside the car, and he was able to get a hold of it and flip the safety off. In his own words, he was planning on shooting the man if he made an aggressive move towards his daughter. while he was at the hospital, it was noted that he was cool and distant, and he demonstrated little or no compassion for others, viewing their difficulties as a product of their own weakness. Further goes on to state that this lack of empathy may lead this youngster to serve only himself, regardless of the consequences for those around him. All of this was noted during his first stay inside of a mental hospital, where part of his intake is a note from his juvenile officer named Jerry Driver that reads, "Court ordered to Mid-South Hospital, suicidal, self-mutilating, made pact with girlfriend and the devil to sacrifice his firstborn." This idea of a child sacrifice is noted throughout Damien's first stint at Charter Hospital, and apparently was based in fact, as Deanna told the West Memphis Police on May 11th, 1993, "I found out that he, meaning Damien, planned to kill our firstborn if it was a girl. Damien would not do it. He is a coward and would have tried to get me to do it. That's when I knew he was nuts and I had nothing else to do with him." Other than his acts of animal cruelty and the stories floating around, even from his own girlfriend, that he had planned on sacrificing a child, are the stories that Damien Echols repeatedly drank the blood of other people. There are stories of him drinking blood that had fallen from Jason Baldwin's nose after Baldwin was in a fight. In fact, the story is that he bent down with one finger, scooped some of it up off the ground, and then sucked his finger dry. Another one comes from when he was in a hospital stay, and he latched onto the neck of another boy who was bleeding from some wound, and that Damien found the idea that people saw him as a blood-drinking vampire humorous, although he later stated that by drinking the blood of others, it granted him powers. And I know it seems like I'm kind of skipping around a bit, we're not delving into too much detail with all of this, but there is so much documented evidence that it would take me not hours, but weeks and months to cover it all. Suffice to say, you know, Damien's psychotic episodes are described in great detail in various psychiatric reports. He had a history of hallucinations, as well as believing he was from another world, possibly an alien, or at other times that there was a demon living inside of him. Other times he stated that he was possessed by the soul of a witch, that he was disassociated from reality. He would see and hear things that weren't really there. He was also subject to what he deemed, as well as psychiatrists termed, manic episodes, where everything would speed up and go really fast. And during these periods of time, Damien had no idea what he said and or did, and would be surprised later when his friends would tell him of the quote-unquote crazy things he had gotten into. I'm gonna read a small abstract from a psychiatric evaluation done on Echols in 2001. "Mr. Echols reported that the intense shift between depression and mania literally drove me crazy. He remembered that everything hurt, from the smell of water to green grass, brown grass. He was exquisitely sensitive to the way people smelled and the smell of water. He described manic episodes when his brain rolled, like a TV that is not adjusted. He believed his brain rolled when it rained or when he was near a large body of water. The change of seasons had a strong effect on him also, especially fall and winter, and made his brain roll constantly. Mr. Echols' overwhelming depression and other problems with mood during childhood and adolescence caused disabling disturbances in his emotions, thoughts, behavior, and physical health. His sleep was irregular. He often had no energy to perform the simplest tasks. His thoughts were paralyzing, sluggish, or racing at speeds he could not control. He felt caught in time and thought it was hopeless even to think about feeling better or gaining control over his life. He ruminated about painful memories and insignificant events. He could not concentrate and became easily confused. It was impossible to make even simple decisions. He cried and sobbed all the time without any understanding of what made him so sad. He had no ability to feel joy or pleasure. He became completely inconsolable and isolated, unable to relate to others in any meaningful way. He was inexplicably sensitive to physical sensations and reacted to the slightest changes in his environment. His body hurt when the sun went up or when the sun went down, when it rained or when it did not rain. He could not stop or escape from the pain. It became a throb that never went away. The result of all this is that Eccles was diagnosed with schizophrenia, disorganized type, and bipolar disorder, manic. Now, he was tested 3 times, twice prior to the murders and once before trial, and all three came to the same conclusions. One thing of note is that it was found he had psychotic thought processes consistent with schizophrenia. And some of this was known quite a bit prior to the murders. In fact, he and his family first came into contact with the Department of Human Services on May 5th, 1992, which is a year exactly before the murders. They came into contact because his sister Michelle had finally come forward and stated that her stepfather had been sexually abusing her from the age of 7 onward. And it came out during all of this that their mother, Pam, knew the abuse was occurring but did absolutely nothing to stop it. During these counseling sessions, his mother told caseworkers that she was most concerned about her son not learning to deal with his rages, and that she believed her son may be dealing with outside simulations, and that he might in fact be crazy. And there was precedence for these fears of her. During Damien's first emergency stay in the hospital, the reasons that were given for this were fire-setting behavior by history, potential danger to property, excessive irritability and anger that is potentially dangerous and persistent, involvement in bizarre and unusual behavior. This was all stuff that his mother knew when they initially began these counseling sessions, and that she was aware of when he was admitted to the psychiatric hospital, which, incidentally, his parents removed him from on June 25th when they suddenly moved to Oregon. Damien was diagnosed on that day as depression, dysthymia, and psychotic disorder, otherwise not specified. He was instructed to continue taking a 150 milligram dose of imipramine daily. Now, it's interesting to note the parents said they were moving to Oregon, but they didn't, because, once again, Damien was back inside the mental hospital on July 24th. Although this was a short-lived stint, they eventually did move to Oregon, with Damien's family consisting of, at that time, his mother Pam, his birth father Joe Hutchinson, and his little sister. Their time in Oregon was apparently not very pleasant. They moved to a place called Aloha, Oregon, which is just outside of Portland. And very quickly, things came to a head. Now, there's a lot of different scenarios out there as to what actually happened. I'm going to go with the dumbed-down version. Basically, Damien ended up in a fight with his father and eventually threatened to eat his heart with a spoon. I'm doing this because there's conflicting reports, with some people saying that this didn't happen, other people saying that he was eating from a can of ice cream and this led to a major fight. And unfortunately, his mother's testimony in anything regarding her son is completely unreliable, as she consistently changes it. The initial report that he had threatened members of his family and was once again sent to a mental institution, which he was at for 2 days, although the family stated that it was actually 2 weeks. While he was at the hospital, he said that he was homesick for his girlfriend and all of his other friends. Should be noted that shortly before returning, Damien had begun going out with Dominie Tyr, although he still pined for Deanna Holcomb. And his intake indicated that he was suicidal, threatening the family. There was drug use, parental concern, RE Satanism. Other notes in the file say, Dad says that Damien has been sniffing gasoline, and then at dinner table tonight, he talks about drinking a bottle of bleach and that it would soon be over. Patient told sister that he would be killing himself in the next 3 days, had made threats to kill himself by hanging with bedsheet or tying socks together, and told grandmother today that he would cut his mother's throat. His father, Joe, would later try and brush this under the carpet when talking with the West Memphis police by saying it was just a misunderstanding and that he had only called the police because he had not been around the boy in 8 years and he knew he had some type of mental imbalance and that he also had knives and did not want the scene to escalate further. So there's this history with Damien and his violent outbursts and mental disorders. By the time that he was released from the hospital in Oregon, it was decided that despite being sent to Oregon with his family as part of his probation, he would be going back to West Memphis. And upon returning to Arkansas by a bus, he began telling his friends that a satanic priestess had followed him from Oregon with the intent of either murdering him or pulling him back into the occult. Upon returning to Arkansas, he went to live with his stepfather, and Damien was eventually popped by his probation officer for violating the conditions of his probation, and he was placed inside of a juvenile detention center, where it was noted by staff and other residents that his mental condition seemed to deteriorate rather rapidly, with Eccles seeming to lose contact with reality. Another resident made a report that he had seen Eccles drinking blood from another resident's scratch, after which he was placed in isolation and on suicide watch. Before being sent back to Charter Hospital on September 14th of 1992, and he remained there until September 22nd of that year. It was noted on the 15th by Charter Hospital that Damien's behavior has become frightening to community members. He had been suspected of witchcraft and or devil worship prior to the incident involving his arrest. Again, thought to be suicidal but not afraid to die, per Damien, knows he can come back. It was noted during this stay that Eccles showed absolutely no observable evidence of emotion, and he appeared anxious and uncomfortable. One of the conditions of Damien's release from the hospital at this point was that he would not participate in occult beliefs. After this, he lived with his stepfather, and in December of 1992, Eccles turned 18. He continued to bounce around West Memphis and even re-entered counseling again in January of 1993. During these counseling sessions, Damien is noted as having said that he could enter other people's minds and influence their decisions and actions, as well as steal of energy from other people, while also stating that he was found with satanic imagery and paraphernalia, as well as having black books that he had himself written. He is noted as describing himself as pretty much hate the human race, and that he sees people in two categories, sheep and wolves. Damien would continue discussing various topics such as these with his counselors from this point forward, as well as putting down on paperwork and telling his counselors that he was quote-unquote a sociopath. I think we're going to leave off the case here with Eccles back in Arkansas in early 1993 going to counseling. Next week, I'm going to dive in a little more to Eccles' character, particularly his interest in girls, before getting into Baldwin and Miss Kelly and their various run-ins with the law, and then hopefully wrapping it up, although there's a possibility this might go to 3 episodes, I'm not certain, but hopefully you have enjoyed it thus far, which if you have, I encourage you to join the Deathcast Facebook group, where we can have an intelligent discussion on the topic. I don't believe in, you know, getting into fights over this. I think we all have our own opinions on this case, and I look forward to hearing those opinions. I hope you have a safe and happy new year, and until next week, stay morbid.
Welcome to the Deathcast.